The Honorable, the Chief Justice and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Jackson has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23-1039, Ames versus the Ohio Department of Youth Services.
Title VII prohibits employers from discriminating against employees on the basis of race, sex, religion, and other protected characteristics. An employee who asserts a claim for unlawful disparate treatment under Title VII must prove that the employer intentionally discriminated against her on one of those protected grounds. Courts typically use a three-step inquiry, commonly known as the McDonnell-Douglas framework, to determine whether a Title VII plaintiff has made the requisite showing of discriminatory intent. At the first step of the McDonnell-Douglas framework, the plaintiff must make what is called a prima facie case by producing enough evidence to support an inference that the employer acted with a discriminatory motive. If the plaintiff clears that hurdle, then at the second step of the inquiry, the burden shifts to the employer to articulate some legitimate, non-discriminatory explanation for the adverse action that it took related to the employee. If the employer provides such a justification, then at the third and final step of the inquiry, the plaintiff has an opportunity to prove that the employer's stated justification is pretextual. This case concerns only the first step of the McDonnell-Douglas inquiry, the prima facie case. Ordinarily, the plaintiff's prima facie burden is not onerous. As our cases explain, it is usually enough for a plaintiff to show that she was qualified for a position but was rejected under circumstances that give rise to an inference of discrimination. In this case, however, the Sixth Circuit held that plaintiffs who are members of majority groups bear an additional burden. Under that circuit's precedent, majority group plaintiffs must present evidence of, quote, background circumstances to support a suspicion that the defendant is that unusual employer who discriminates against the majority, end quote. The Sixth Circuit has explained that such additional evidence might include evidence that a member of the relevant minority group made the employment decision at issue, or statistical evidence showing a pattern of discrimination against members of the majority group. Today, we reject the background circumstances requirement. The petitioner in this case is Marlene Ames, a heterosexual woman who worked for Ohio's Juvenile Corrections Agency. Ames applied to be promoted to a management position within the agency, but was rejected, and a lesbian woman was ultimately selected for the role. Ames was then demoted shortly thereafter, and her old job was given to a gay man. Ames responded by filing this Title VII discrimination lawsuit. She alleged that the agency had discriminated against her on the basis of her sexual orientation. The lower courts rejected her claim in reliance on the Sixth Circuit's background circumstances rule for majority group plaintiffs. That is, the courts below held that Ames' suit failed because she had not offered evidence to suggest that the employer agency is that unusual employer who discriminates against heterosexual people. We granted certiorari and now hold that the Sixth Circuit's background circumstances rule cannot be squared with the text of Title VII or our precedents construing that statute. By its plain terms, Title VII's disparate treatment provision prohibits employers from discriminating against, quote, any individual, end quote. Because the statute draws no distinctions between majority group employees and minority group employees, courts cannot impose a heightened evidentiary burden on one group and not the other. Our case law reaffirms that basic principle. In Griggs versus Duke Power Company, for instance, we stated that Title VII prohibits discriminatory preference for any group, minority or majority. And more recently, in Bostock versus Clayton County, we stressed that the statute works to protect individuals of both sexes from discrimination and does so equally. The Sixth Circuit background circumstances rule does not comport with those decisions. For its part, Ohio does not dispute that Title VII imposes the same standards on majority group plaintiffs and minority group plaintiffs. But in its view, the background circumstances rule does not actually impose any additional burdens on majority group plaintiffs. Instead, it argues that rule merely implements this court's precedents, recognizing that the prima facie burden can vary from case to case. That argument is actually belied by the Sixth Circuit's own description and application of the background circumstances rule in this case. The Sixth Circuit's opinion explicitly states that Ames bore an additional evidentiary burden because she is heterosexual, and that she would have easily satisfied her prima facie burden if she were not a member of the majority group. We thus cannot accept Ohio's attempt to recast the decision below. We further decline to reach Ohio's alternative arguments for affirmance, each of which falls beyond the scope of the question presented. Accordingly, we vacate the judgment of the Sixth Circuit and remand for application of the proper prima facie standard. The judgment of the court is unanimous. Justice Thomas has filed a concurring opinion.
Justice Kagan has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23-1141, Smith & Wesson Brands versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos.
Mexico has a serious gun violence problem, which its government views as coming from north of the border. Mexico says that gun traffickers purchase firearms in the United States, very often in illegal transactions, and deliver them to drug cartels in Mexico, where they're used to commit the worst kinds of crimes, including murder and kidnapping. Wanting to hold someone in this country accountable, Mexico brought this civil lawsuit against six American gun manufacturers, among them Colt, Glock, and Smith & Wesson. The basic theory of the suit is that those companies should pay damages for all the harm their products cause in Mexico when cartel members use them. But Mexico's suit faces a problem right at the outset. A few decades ago, American cities tried to bring similar suits against gun manufacturers, and Congress passed a law to prevent them. The main provision of that law, whose acronym is PLICA, says that no one can sue a firearms manufacturer for injuries that stem from the criminal or unlawful misuse of guns by a third party like a Mexican cartel member. So the statute would seem to bar Mexico's action. But PLICA has an exception, which Mexico says allows its suit to go forward. The exception applies when, among other things, the defendant manufacturer has, and I'm quoting here, when the manufacturer has knowingly violated a state or federal statute applicable to the sale or marketing of firearms. Mexico says the defendant manufacturers in its suit meet that requirement because they aided and abetted some dealers in their distribution chain to illegally sell firearms to Mexican gun traffickers. The question for us is whether Mexico plausibly pleaded that allegation. We hold that it did not, so its lawsuit must be dismissed. The bulk of our opinion has to do with aiding and abetting law. To aid and abet a crime, a person or entity, as the case may be, must intend to facilitate the offense and must act to do so. A canonical statement of what that means is that a person must participate in the crime as in something that he wishes to bring about and must seek by his action to make the crime succeed. Inactions and omissions usually aren't enough. Nor is it enough if the person or entity engages in routine activity that happens on occasion, incidentally, if you will, to assist a crime. So a business doesn't become liable for all criminal misuses of its goods, even if it knows that in some fraction of cases, that kind of downstream use will in fact occur. Those principles mean that Mexico's suit can't succeed. It's not enough for aiding and abetting liability to say, as Mexico has, that the manufacturers are aware that some proportion of their dealer network violates firearms laws. And it's not enough to say, as Mexico has, that the manufacturers could have taken proactive steps to prevent that from happening, for example, by supervising their dealers more closely. It could be enough if the manufacturers knew who the rogue dealers were and did something to help along their gun violations. But Mexico has not plausibly pleaded that allegation. It has claimed it to be true, but in a wholly non-specific way and without anything to back up the charge. And even at this early stage of litigation, when we don't expect a plaintiff to have a lot of its evidence, even at this early stage, that kind of simple speculation cannot save Mexico's suit. The opinion of the court is unanimous. Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson have filed concurring opinions.
Justice Sotomayor has the opinion of the court today in case 24154, Catholic Charities Bureau versus the Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission.
Wisconsin, like many other states, exempts certain religious entities from paying unemployment compensation taxes. One such exemption covers nonprofits that are controlled by a church and, quote, operated primarily for religious purposes, close quote. Petitioners, Catholic Charities Bureau, and four of the entities that it operates claim that they qualify for the exemption as religious organizations controlled by the Roman Catholic Church and whose charitable work is motivated by church doctrine. The Wisconsin Supreme Court disagreed. It concluded that petitioners are not operated primarily for religious purposes within the meaning of the statute because they neither inculcate religious faith nor serve only Catholics in their charitable work. The court today holds that Wisconsin's tax exemption, as applied to petitioner, violates the First Amendment. The Wisconsin Supreme Court's interpretation of the state's exemption turned on inherently religious choices about how to perform charitable work, much like decisions about whether to baptize members or hold services on Sundays. Wisconsin's regime thus explicitly differentiates between religions based on theological practices, thereby triggering strict scrutiny. Yet the state has not met its burden to justify the law's application under that demanding standard, which requires narrow tailoring to a compelling state interest. First, Wisconsin asserts an interest in ensuring unemployment coverage for its citizens. The lines drawn by the exemption, however, are under-inclusive. The statute exempts over 40 forms of employment from its compensation program, including employment at religious entities that provide services similar to petitioners when the work is done directly by the church as opposed to a nonprofit-affiliated corporation. Second, Wisconsin claims an interest in avoiding entanglement in employment decisions based on religious doctrine. However, the exemption is over-inclusive as to that goal. It covers all employees working at qualified organizations, not just those who inculcate religious faith or engage in other types of religious work relevant to the state's entanglement concerns. For these and other reasons set forth in our opinion, the court reverses and remands for further proceedings consistent with the opinion. The decision of the court is unanimous. Justices Thomas and Jackson have each filed concurring opinions.
Justice Alito has the opinion of the court this morning in case 23-1201, C.C. Davis versus Antrix Corporation and the consolidated case.
Foreign sovereigns are presumptively immune from suit in United States court, but that immunity is not absolute. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act strips immunity for and grants jurisdiction over an enumerated list of claims against foreign states and their instrumentalities. In these consolidated cases, we interpret the Act's personal jurisdiction provision. That provision says personal jurisdiction, quote, shall exist, close quote, whenever two conditions are satisfied. First, an enumerated exception must apply, and second, the foreign defendant must be properly served under the Act's specialized service of process rules. The Ninth Circuit, however, added a third requirement found nowhere in the text, namely, the plaintiff must also prove that the foreign state has made, quote, minimum contacts with the United States sufficient to satisfy the due process test the court first announced in 1945 in a famous case called International Shoe. Today, the court holds that the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act's personal jurisdiction provision includes no such requirement. We interpret the text to mean exactly what it says. Personal jurisdiction shall exist when an immunity exception applies and service is proper. We therefore reverse the judgment of the Ninth Circuit and remand the case for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. The opinion of the court is unanimous.
Justice Thomas has the opinion of the court this morning, case 23-1259, Bloom Bank versus Honickman.
This case comes to us on a writ of certiorari to the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 60B allows a district court to grant relief from a final judgment in enumerated circumstances. Rule 60B-6 is a catch-all provision that permits district courts to provide such relief only in extraordinary circumstances. Petitioners, respondents here, are victims and families of victims of terrorist attacks carried out by Hamas. They sued petitioner Bloom Bank, alleging that it had aided and abetted Hamas's commission of the attacks. The district court dismissed the complaint on the ground that plaintiffs had failed to state a claim, and the Second Circuit affirmed. The plaintiffs then moved under Rule 60B-6 to vacate the district court's final judgment so that they could file an amended complaint. The district court denied their motion, holding that they failed to demonstrate the extraordinary circumstances necessary to receive relief. The plaintiffs appealed again, and this time the Second Circuit reversed. The court held that when a party seeks vacature under Rule 60B in order to file an amended complaint, a district court must balance Rule 60B's focus on finality against Rule 15A's liberal repleting standard. In an opinion filed with the clerk today, we reverse. Relief under Rule 60B-6 requires extraordinary circumstances. That standard does not become less demanding when a Rule 60B-6 movement also hopes to amend his complaint. Rather, a party seeking to reopen his case must first satisfy Rule 60B on its own terms before Rule 15A's liberal amendment standard can apply. Because the Second Circuit's approach conflates the order of operations and dilutes Rule 60B-6's standard, we disagree with its approach. For these reasons and others set forth in our opinion, we reverse the judgment of the Second Circuit. Justice Jackson has filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment.
In Laboratory Corporation of America Holdings versus Davis, number 24304, the writ of certiorari is dismissed as improvidently granted. Justice Kavanaugh has filed a dissenting opinion. Mr. Clerk, the court will entertain motions for admission to the bar of the court.
Michael Roberts.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I move the admission of Saiman Denai of the Bar of the District of Columbia. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Denai will be admitted.
Timothy Barquette.
Mr. Barquette.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I move the admission of my son, Dylan George Barquette of the Bar of the State of Florida. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your son will be admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your son will be admitted. Thank you.
Bentley Adams.
Mr. Adams.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Bentley Childs Adams IV of the Bar of the State of Georgia. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Adams will be admitted.
Amy Coyle.
Ms. Coyle.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Samuel Ernest Roth of the Bar of the State of New York. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Roth will be admitted.
Gary Malfrus.
Mr. Malfrus.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of Musa Donald Martin of the Bar of the Commonwealth of Virginia. I am satisfied he possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and Mr. Martin will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the American Bar Association, presented by Albert Harvey.
Mr. Harvey.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys from the state of California: Douglas William Aberrot, Timothy Lawrence Alger, Jerome Anthony Clay Jr., Donald Albert English, Ojen Gina Oinyen, David John Weiland, Christy Efin Yee, from the District of Columbia, Andre William Boscom, Anthony Robert Gutman, Stuart Allen Weinstein Buckle, from the state of Florida, Terrence Craig Avala, Brian Joseph Barakut, Giacoma Bosa, Ali Sharar Iftikhar, Shanar Zalman Kass, Carl Wayne Labertu, Emily Elizabeth Mickey, Ellen Julia Von Gaso, Luboy Zeldis, from the state of Georgia, Stephen Lee Bevins, from Iowa, Ashley Elizabeth Frazier Morrison, from Indiana, Michelle Annette Aldabella, Hannah Andrade, Charles Benedict Baldwin, from the state of Kansas, Anthony Frederick Rupp, from the state of Louisiana, Danielle Lauren Borrell, Anthony Dwayne Winters, from the state of Massachusetts, Lisa Marie Milam, Talia Noelle Simons, from Michigan, Allison Folmar, from Minnesota, Craig Donald Peterson, from the state of Missouri, Julia Ann Cheney Fawnin, David Edwin Wilson, from New Hampshire, Jason Bub Hebert, from New Jersey, Elliot Jonathan Stein, from New York, Taylor Lauren Frazier, Bruce Dennis Johnson, Layla Mary Cassis, Jones Paula Lopez, from Ohio, Karen Nadine Nielsen, from Oklahoma, Timothy Patrick Clancy, from Pennsylvania, Christine Lauren Kalalang, from Rhode Island, Robert M. Barge, from the state of Tennessee, James Hugh McKinnon, Jr. From Texas, Christina Adore Anderson. Cheryl Tatar Dasho. Jennifer Helena Hill. Andre Ian Warshaw. From the state of Utah, Melissa Lee Markey. From the state of Virginia, Lisa Marie Matthews. I am satisfied that each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Phi Alpha Delta Law Fraternity, presented by Dietrich von Biedenfeld.
Mr. von Biedenfeld.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys. From the state of Alabama, Cheryl May Ivory. Elizabeth Miller Zwiebel. From the state of Arizona, Jennifer Lynn Schroeder. From the state of California, Aaron Paul Morris. Lieutenant Commander Kimmy Kato Schulteis. From the District of Columbia, Christopher Brett Alexander, Daniel Michael Caves, Margaret Palmer Dawson, Anthony Green Jr., Omar Zohair Karam. From the state of Florida, Jessica Tibisai Bracho, Damian Kirkpatrick Reynolds, Carolyn Ann Stewart. From the state of Georgia, Alicia Cantrell Gant. From the state of Illinois, Ronald William Cobb Jr., Stephen J. Judge, June Marcia McCoy, Diana Lynn Mitchell, Alfred Charles Sanchez. From the state of Indiana, Natalie Shanique Williams. From the state of Kentucky, Brooklyn McCann Girdley, Daryl Glenn Messer II. From the state of Louisiana, Maurice Darnell Gibson. From the state of Maryland, Aaron Patrick Leonidas Blevins. Alyssa Marie Ruth Frederick. Sarah Sakenejad. From the state of Minnesota, Lisa Marie Neary. From the state of Missouri, Mary White Sheffield. Michael Merrill Wilson. From the state of Mississippi, Duran D'Angelo Davis. From the state of New Jersey, Stacy Lee Calloway. From the state of New York, John David Lampfear, Evelyn Jeanette Maldonado Guzman, Tolulupe Oluwafun Milajor Odukoya, Maisha Andrea Ruff. From the state of South Carolina, Nina Nicole Sperling. From the state of Tennessee, Timothy Christian Chambers, George Brandon Gillum, Idi Belkis Melendez. From the state of Texas, Denise Irene Kurt, Joel Stephen Shacker. From the state of Wisconsin, Nancy Ann Krieg. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted.
A group of attorneys from the Women's Bar Association of the State of New York, presented by Mindy Zadagora.
Ms. Zadagora.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I move the admission of the following attorneys of the Bar of the State of New York: Ann Ball, Carla Ann Barone, Jennifer Christine Baim, Rosanna Berardi, Danielle Ernestina Bernard, Jessica Brunis, Valerie Ann Casale, Catherine Elizabeth Courtney, Adrian Doreen Edwards, Lisette Costa Ferreira, Amarilda Barami Flickstein, Colleen Marie Gibbons, Melissa Fran Glassman, Robert Preston Hamilton Jr., Dawn A. Lott, Anne Marie Merzen, Lisa Beth Narayan, Teresa Rose Nuncio, Sarah Jane Combi Reckes, Atasia Rache Richardson, Lauren Elizabeth Scott, Sukana Sorari, Shari Lee Sugarman, Angela Antonia Taragoza, Jill Marie Wenick. I am satisfied each possesses the necessary qualifications.
Your motion is granted, and the applicants will be admitted. If all of the applicants will stand, the clerk will administer the oath. But before he does so, I would like to extend to each of you a warm welcome as a member of the bar of this court and an officer of the court.
Raise your right hand, please. Do you solemnly swear that as an attorney and as a counselor of this court, you will conduct yourself uprightly and according to law, and that you will support the Constitution of the United States, so help you God?
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Thursday, the 12th of June at 10 o'clock.